CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello, and welcome to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First segment of our show is a post-dated interview, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Juanita Butler will be telling us a little bit about her disabilities work.
So what can you tell me about your work in the rare disease world?
My name is Juanita Butler, and I'm a co-founder and board member for the Foundation for Condylar Resorption. Condylar resorption is a rare disease wherein the bones, the joints of the TMJs, the TMJ joints, wear away and are reabsorbed into the body. It's idiopathic, meaning they're not really sure how it happens. And it affects mostly women, like all TMJ issues. So we started this foundation. We're three patients, and we started the foundation because there really is not a lot of information out there for condylar resorption, and it's frustrating, just the lack of knowledge, just basic knowledge about the disease, which is not nearly as common, as uncommon as a lot of places believe. There's just a lack of knowledge from practitioners who can perform surgeries or other procedures that will really impact people with condylar resorption.
So that being said, do you know offhand about how many people are affected?
I don't think anyone really knows. When I was diagnosed in 2019, I was trying to find everything online of like, oh my gosh, what is this? I had never heard the term idiopathic condylar resorption. What is this? So, you know, I'm Googling everything, and I could find two scientific papers. I think one of them said that there were 168 people in the world who had this. I eventually found a support group on Facebook. All of the co-founders of the foundation found this support group for idiopathic condylar resorption. Back in 2019, I believe there were about 300 members of the support group. So I thought that 168 worldwide number was strange. Also, those numbers were only coming from a clinic in South Korea and Norway, or two different clinics. That support group on Facebook now has almost 4,000 members. And, you know, new people are joining every week. I think one of, like, the ways that we started being activists before starting the foundation was seeing people, idiopathic condylar resorption, if you have the disease, your face, it's hard to explain, but like you can kind of see the exact disease on someone's face. You can see when the joints are flattening, are changing shape. It shows in a very specific way on the face. So myself and a few other members from the idiopathic condylar resorption group, I started seeing like we were on this much larger jaw, like blanket jaw surgery group. And we could see people on that jaw surgery group moving forward and getting the, well, a not very effective jaw surgery, and one that can very negatively impact you if you have condylar resorption. So, you know, we started just cautioning those people, like, hey, at least get a scan to see if your joints are okay. You're obviously have like the ratio of your jaw joints shrinking. It makes pretty specific changes to the face, such as an anterior open bite. It usually happens in a shorter amount of time, and it's rotating your jaw back into your neck as well. So there are all sorts of breathing problems.
So,
and it's very specific. So does that answer your question?
Absolutely. So I'm curious, does the foundation do anything as far as providing anything on the mental health side of things, like you're dealing with this condition, here's how to keep a positive attitude and seek help when you need it?
Yeah, well, that's actually one of my passion projects, or one of my areas of focus, because it was such an incredibly difficult time for me, mental health-wise. So yeah, I have an article on the website, I can send it to you, of ways to take care of yourself during the time of, you know, navigating a rare disease is really, like, you know, really difficult for your mental health. You're kind of like, you can feel quite alone in a sea of people who don't really understand. It can be kind of triggering to be talking with a lot of doctors who we tend to kind of just like fall back on thinking that they're the experts, but they might not actually have any information about your disease, and you might have to educate them, and you might have to learn about it. And for myself, and this is one of the reasons why we started this foundation, we didn't want people to have to become, like, you know, a medical expert. Like, we wanted to compile everything that took us years to figure out and to learn from different sources online, from different papers. And also part of that is the mental health aspect of how living with a rare disease, it's not very apparent to the people around you. They can tell that your face has changed, but it happens gradually enough to where it's generally not shocking to the people who you live with and are friends with, or, you know, family, over the time. And you might be having this really difficult time and might think, God, I look so different, I don't know what's going on. And it can be very isolating and difficult, like I said, because a lot of the so-called experts are not really an expert in your field or in your disease. So again, it's very isolating. I really try to encourage people who have ICR or any rare disease to take that extra care of themselves, because it's an unusual position, and I think we can often discount it when we're going through it, but it does require extra attention and care.
So, in your time with the foundation, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Success moment. I'm not sure that I can really point to, like, I mean, I think just like getting it off the ground is a successful moment. But watching the patient stories, seeing how people are scared, exhausted, alone, confused when they come in, when they first make contact, like with the support group on Facebook, to watching them reach out to doctors, find the experts that they need that actually are going to be able to help them, and then get treatment from those experts. And, like, honestly, I think a successful moment, some people stay behind, like I did, like our co-founders have done, to stay behind to help the people who are coming in. But a lot of people also just like go on with their lives and live their lives after, you know, they come in like so dejected and alone, they find the care that they need to find and the support during the whole time. And, you know, it's often require surgery. Surgery is often not a perfect science. And then they go and they get better and they are able to live their lives again where they were not living their lives before. So yeah, I would actually have to say that's a hugely successful thing that I've been lucky enough to see, you know, many, many women go through.
Like, thank you. Where can people go to find out more about ICR?
You can go to www.condylarresorption.org. It's CONDYLARRESORP, as in...
Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah.
In this segment of our show, Ben Fulton will be giving us an update on his advocacy efforts. So what's the latest with your advocacy efforts?
Well, let's see. Over the summer, we were able to finish our written submissions that were basically supplementary to the hearing that was had in May of this year. And basically, this was a hearing for some of the listeners that may not have been following it earlier that had to do with the housing rights of people in Ontario. Basically, we challenged the part of the Human Rights Code that allows landlords that are sharing a kitchen or bathroom with the tenants to discriminate on any one of the prohibited grounds. This challenge was to eliminate discrimination that is experienced by persons with disabilities and other minorities when they're looking for housing in the available renting market. The hearing was had in May, and the written submissions were submitted at the end of June. We're still waiting to hear back, get a decision from the tribunal member, but our hope is for the decision to be favorable, and that would allow further challenges, future challenges, to be successful.
So, in the meantime, I understand there's a new campaign you're working on related to balance.
Oh yeah, there's the Because of Balance campaign. So Balance for Blind Adults, their organization that does work with adults that have a vision disability. They do a lot of tech training. They have a lot of available resources. They do like peer support groups. They have like adventures and like gaming nights that they organize. And so the Because of Balance campaign is basically a fundraising effort that is there to support you know, the different events that they run throughout the year. They rely on the fundraising to be able to run more events that aren't covered by the basic grants that they get from the provincial government each year.
So, how are they going about reaching out in this campaign to let the public know that, that it's there for them?
Well, they have a fundraiser on Canada Helps. I've shared that on my Facebook. So a lot of social media is being used. I think they're trying to raise about $30,000 this year. I think they've passed $10,000 so far. And I've raised a few hundred of that myself. So people who are interested can follow me on Facebook and contribute to the campaign by making a donation.
So in your own experiences with Balance, what are some of the biggest supports they've given you over time?
Tech training was really huge for me. It doesn't sound like a big thing, but in order to use a smartphone with the adaptive technology, I had to learn a lot of different gestures and swipes and like two and three, even some four finger commands. It's, you know, almost like a whole nother language. So their tech training really helped me with, you know, understanding how to use and work with a smartphone. They've helped me with, you know, some computer applications. Also, they had some counseling services that were provided that were very useful to me during the pandemic. And they have different events that they do. I actually took a pottery class through them that I found very, very satisfying, very enjoyable. I made some goblets and a candle holder.
So, do you ever find there are any myths or misperceptions about whether a person with a vision impairment can make use of technology or do things like the pottery class you described? And if so, how do you get around those myths and demonstrate that, that there is capability there?
Yeah, I think certainly something like pottery and other art. I think there are a lot of misconceptions around, blind people being able to create art. And, when you think about it, pottery, it's very tactile. You're physically manipulating it with your hands, And so, to me, it was like a very natural expression of art. And I think it's really good. I think another misconception people have is sometimes that, people with disability, they don't need to express themselves in that way. And so, having these classes that gives people an outlet for their artistic expression, I think is really important because it, really contributes to the whole human experience and not just like a segmented part that we sometimes see.
So, personally, I think it's really amazing that you're being a part of this campaign for Balance, giving back after they supported you. What would the ideal outcome be for this fundraiser?
Well, my personal goal is $600. I think I'm about halfway towards that right now. And I think their goal for this year is $30,000.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for programs like that, and also to keep pushing forward for the rights of individuals with disabilities, what would you say?
I'd say that, it's really important that these kinds of programs are out there to help people get the skills that they need to succeed professionally. And also that there are these kinds of programs out there that, go beyond, just focusing on work, that they actually engage with, like I said, the whole person. It's important to, have different experiences. I think mental health is really important, and part of that is expression, part of that is counseling, and it's important for us to maintain and look after these needs. And it's important to have these resources available to help people with that.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Thanks. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Juanita Butler told us a little bit about ICR, and Ben Fulton gave us an update on his advocacy efforts. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Sean Wiltshire about his latest disability employment work. So what's been the latest with your disability employment work?
So actually, we're still seeing a recovery from the pandemic, Cam. We're still seeing in larger metropolitan areas that jobs are available. The connection issue still remains the same. It's how do employers learn about being disability confident, or it's similar to any kind of a new idea that people are being brought into, that the idea that inclusion or diversity is good for the bottom line is still resonating with a lot of employers. Now, there is always a constant debate around, is it a labor market issue or is it a wage issue based on demographics? But we know that Canada has a goal of bringing in 400,000 new Canadians every year. So some of these issues are demographic and some of them are wage. I don't think anyone is responsible for all of the challenges employers have, but we definitely see availability of talent as one of the issues, and also what wage rate those folks are going to be able to earn during the time that they're employed. And then, of course, in July of this year, Stats Canada released some new information about the pay gaps between folks with disabilities and folks without disabilities. Now, while we're using data that is pre-pandemic, 2019, it's the only data we have available right now, but in that fact sheet, we've learned from Statistics Canada that there is still a 21.4% wage gap between folks with disabilities and folks without disabilities. So we do know that that did not recover during the pandemic, and that probably got higher. So we'll look for more data as we move forward around the earning potential and the actual earned dollars for folks with disabilities post-pandemic as new statistics become available to us. But often the challenge with these statistics is they're a little bit older, and so we often have to sort of extrapolate mm-hmm. some current information out of the trends that we see in these statistics. So there's lots of things going on with new work. Folks who are neurodiverse are also stepping up, and we're seeing more folks being able to enter the workforce and their neurodiversity to be celebrated and thought of as an asset versus a deficit.
So I'm curious, do you think that some of the employment gaps might be on the basis that an employer might say, I can't be fully accommodating, I can't be fully diverse, so I'm not even going to make that effort? Do you think there's ever that hesitance there?
Absolutely. It's a concept that folks are often unsure of. I don't want to say uncomfortable, because it's probably not the right word to describe it. What we do know is that business owners and senior leaders and managers are very busy addressing the day-to-day issues. They often think that a inclusionary policy or a policy that promotes diversity is more fluff than reality. And so it's really demonstrating those success stories so that we have those champions. It's often hard when you've been doing this for 30 years like I have, that people say, you know what to say, Sean, you know what to tell me. And so we've moved from that idea that we often now have other people speak on our behalf. And so it's those other employers who would say to a new employer, I had the same feelings you did. I was unsure. I did not know. But what I did know was that I needed to fill this position because my company's bottom line was suffering. And there are organizations supported by government throughout this country to the tune of several billion dollars that are there to help employers make those connections and understand those nuanced things that folks with disabilities often present. We know that folks with disabilities have the skills to work. They have the desire to work. Now what we need is the opportunity to not only go to work, but to rise up in your career. You don't want to enter and be at the same position. So we're kind of doing two things at once. We're trying to promote the idea that diversity helps the bottom line of companies, but we're also hoping to promote for individuals who take these positions that don't stop at one. There's lots of steps on the corporate ladder, or there's lots of steps on a job ladder. You need to be able to be like everybody else and have the opportunity to take those steps as well. So I think we're kind of addressing two problems, but again, it's that long-term solution and education. So it's not a lack of ability to offer the job. It's the lack of ability. What happens when I do offer the job? How do I manage to support that individual to get the most for my business. And so sometimes it takes a little bit of time for people to understand how people may communicate in a different manner or may need a different accommodation. But we've been accommodating folks inside workplaces for lots and lots of decades. So it's just one more thing that makes your business responsive and also makes your business more profitable, because you're able to fill the HR needs that you have. And as everybody knows, companies are in business to make a product, and employing people to make that product is part of the process. It has to exist. So it's a kind of a twofold problem, Cam, and I don't think any one thing is responsible for the result that we're seeing today, which is, you know, a continued pay gap, a continued misunderstanding of the real skills that people have.
So despite the pay gap and the obvious upturn in housing costs, grocery costs, that sort of thing, do you have any advice for someone with a disability trying to get into the workforce to try and just minimize the damage on that and to actually find something meaningful?
Yeah, I actually do. I think it's a journey that none of us can take alone. I think that having both a sounding board or somebody in your corner to give you some support or to help you navigate those worlds. What I've discovered working with folks who are living on the autism spectrum is that one of the things they need most is language. How do I put this in words that folks would understand that I have skills, but I have some nuanced communication needs? So my advice to folks that are looking for employment is to reach out to organizations that are there to help you. It's not a case of you need the help, but it's a case of there's help available, so we should accept it. The other thing I'd like to say, Cam, is that I often get asked by employers when I give a presentation or a speech, Sean, what is the one thing I can do today, leaving this meeting, that will help me increase my diversity without having to change 40 company policies or to do a lot of things that they feel are cumbersome? My advice to every employer listening and employers that we run into is starting today, when you ask someone to come in for an interview, whether that be virtual or in person, if you simply ask, is there any accommodation that we could provide for you that will make the interview more accessible or easy for you, please let us know. Now, for many folks, that will mean nothing. It will just mean they were being blunt. But for many folks that you and I know, Cam, it's an indicator that I'm willing, I'm open, and I understand that there could be accommodations. And by saying it up front, they are setting themselves up to be an employer that sees diversity as valuable, but also understands that it's a journey. So that they're giving the person an opportunity to say, oh, hey, you know, I really do well on Zoom, or if you could give me a couple of the questions before so that I can help formulate my answers, because sometimes I have difficulty answering questions on the spot. It gives the opportunity both for the individual and the business to kind of meet halfway. So for folks looking for work, it's reach out to those experts in the community that are there to help. And for employers, it's ask that simple question, how can I accommodate or support you to come for this interview to find out how you could make my company better?
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. There are times, my friends, I think disability simply comes down to a different way of perceiving the world. What Ben described in his interview about something as simple as a pottery class, something able-bodied society might ask, what's the point of having them do it? They won't appreciate it. Instead of looking at it from a different lens and saying, how can we make this something that's a worthwhile experience for them? In what way can their other senses perceive this? The truth about art is, it's not the same to any two of us in this world. How it affects us is a unique experience. And whether you see things differently, you hear things differently, you think about them differently, truth is, art is a very subjective thing, and a person with a disability is no less entitled to enjoy it.
This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.